The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we still, to a large extent,
live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast.
Neil Trotter, welcome to the Zero Books YouTube channel and to the Zero Books podcast. I'm glad to get a chance to talk to you. You are the man behind the Black Ponderer YouTube channel. Mm-hmm. And today we're going to have a little bit of a different conversation, talking as philosophers or amateur philosophers, maybe, rather than as political radicals, which is the usual approach on the channel. Mm-hmm. So, Neil, tell me a little bit about yourself. How did you come to start a YouTube channel about philosophy? Yeah, and how did you get interested in the subject enough to become an expert or a talking head in it?
Oh, well, I've always been interested in philosophy ever since I was a little kid. But in terms of the YouTube channel, I started that basically to get myself out of a rut, like an emotional rut. I have a side business, it's an event planning business, where we host events, conventions and festivals. And there was one year we did not do very well financially, and it was just a mess. So during that time, we had to like close the business down for a little bit, and I started just, what is it, binging YouTube. That's like when I first started checking out YouTube. I think this was like 2013. Yes. And I wasn't even aware really of YouTube, what it was. I just thought it was a place where people watched kitten videos and people getting kicked in the balls and such. But then I looked at it and I was like, oh, okay, it's a lot of content. Then I wonder, like, is there anybody out there making content about books? Or specifically philosophy books? That would be cool. So I looked and I couldn't really find that much of that. I saw a few people who were doing philosophy videos on philosophy topics, but I was specifically looking for like just the books, getting people interested in books. Mm-hmm. Eventually I found that there were some people talking about books, but there's a lot of people, but they're mostly, I encountered like young adult type of books, which I wasn't interested in, but they were very passionate about what they were talking about.
Yeah.
So I was kind of blown away by that. So I thought to myself, I could do that. That'll be a great project. I could do that. I'll take me out of this rut. I'll just talk about books the way these little kids are talking about the books, or these young adults are talking about the books, but in a very passionate way. But I'll talk about the books that I'm passionate about, which is philosophy books.
Welcome to the Black Ponderer. I'm Neil Trotter, your host. And today, we're going to be discussing some more continental philosophy. We're going to be returning to Hegel, and we're going to be discussing his lectures, specifically his lectures on the history of philosophy. This is volume 2 of that. And let me pose for the thumbnail. Mm-hmm. Get a good shot here.
You said that you started reading philosophy when you were a kid, or being interested in philosophy when you were a kid. How did that come about? How did you get introduced to philosophy as a kid?
Well, I think really how it started was Japanese animation, anime. I was a little kid. Yeah, my older brother used to work at the CD stores, like Tower Records or Virgin records, those stores that, you know, they don't really exist now. And they were, for a while, for like a little bit, they were trying to skin into the anime business. They were selling anime on VHS cassette tapes, but they couldn't sell them. People weren't interested in it yet. I guess it just wasn't mainstream that yet. So they would, the company would just give away these tapes to the employees because they weren't selling them. So my brother got a lot of those animes, and I watched a lot of what he got. And what I was interested in the most was these really deep, philosophical anime, like Ghost in Shell, for instance, or Akira was another one that was really heady. I also liked this one called Neon Genesis Evangelion. You know, the really heady ones. Ghost in the Shell, eventually I figured out that movie was about what it was, a critique about technology, and there was talking about how you know, there's this idea that technology takes away our humanity, or is it making us less human? But their argument was, no, actually, technology is making us even more human.
Well, one of the things you said in your introductory video to your channel is that you feel like philosophy can help us understand and maybe even overcome social problems in a way that neither science nor religion can.
The reason why these problems aren't solved is because we're not looking at them in a philosophical way. For example, climate change is a huge problem. It's got a lot of it's very grand, right? And so a lot of people, they get intimidated by even tackling the problem. They're like, well, there's nothing we can do about this. It's so huge, right? But philosophy, it teaches you to, and a philosophical approach is breaking down these large problems into little small problems, or like looking at it step by step, you know, in a way that you can solve it, you know?
Yeah, well, my temptation would be to say, well, the first thing you have to do when it comes to climate change is try to understand why it is that we can't seem to control the level of pollution or the way in which we produce things. Why are we driven to, let's say, rely so heavily on fossil fuels? Why has there been so little development of alternative energy sources? And then you might start to say, well, the profit motive is a big part of that. Mm-hmm. And so then you get, I mean, of course, I'm already predisposed to a certain kind of answer, right? Like the Marxist kind of answer. But but I do think that you're right that rather than trying to take it piece by piece in a kind of non-systematic way, but rather instead try to reduce it down to its essentials, we might be able to begin to approach the issue of climate change.
Yeah, and what you just did was a philosophical approach, right? You know, you're saying you're taking a Marxist approach, but really you're being philosophical about it, right, as opposed to like, oh, I don't believe in climate change because I'm a Republican or something, or like I'm a Southerner or something, or like, oh, you're just this left-wing radical, like that's why I don't believe in climate. You know, it's just this shutting down of dialogue immediately, or like not really getting at like, okay, what really is this problem? Right, just sitting there analyzing it. Yeah.
How is it that neither science nor religion can, I mean, I can kind of see why religion wouldn't be able to address this problem, because religion is based on doctrinaire faith, or dogmatic faith, but I'm not sure why science wouldn't also be an approach that would like reduce the problem down to simpler questions and give us an access to how to solve it. And obviously with climate change, some sort of scientific understanding has got to be essential.
Mm-hmm. Well, you just use philosophy in conjunction with science, or like what I'm saying, science is not enough, where science, it is an essential tool, right? It gives you the information you need to solve the issue. But people need more than that, right? They need something to believe in or hold on to, or like they need like a something that speaks to them spiritually. And for many people, science does that for them. But for many people, it is not enough. Like, they need something more. So that's why I say, like, the philosophical, you know, when you make these scientific claims, like, you know, when you say climate change will inevitably hurt, will reduce the amount of humanity's ability to exist in the future, which is, like, you know, you can back it up with science. Then you might approach, like, a religious person, that they'll be like, well, maybe this is God's will, or this and that, another thing, or you know, you need to start talking about, okay, let's talk about, like, how is this, what I'm talking to you scientifically, how can I tie that into God's will or something? Like, how is it both God's will and scientific truth? And I think that bridge, that philosophical bridge, helps to, you know, to tie it, to bring in more people.
Mm-hmm. You know? Well, this kind of moves me to Kierkegaard. Would you say that you, if you were going to claim, like, a philosophical position for yourself, tag yourself with a label, that you would embrace maybe the existential Christianity of someone like Kierkegaard?
Yeah, I think so. For the most part, yeah, I think I'm aligned with him. I just really, really like how Kierkegaard was not about, he was more about, yeah, explaining the experience of being a Christian, like a real Christian. And he wasn't about trying to give, like, an argument about the existence of God. Like, okay, this is why God exists, and I can show it to you. Through my philosophy. He wasn't about that. He was just about, like, what's important is the experience, and more so than, like, me trying to prove to you that the experience is valid or not. It's just about, this is the experience. Yeah, that's what I really like about Kierkegaard. I think people, you know, Christians, and then people who don't believe in your religion in general, we get too caught up in this, like, well, you know, science shows that God doesn't exist, or how, you know, there's no proof that God exists. Or even Christians will be like, well, I know God exists because this and this. But the reality is, you don't know. Like, even if you're truly honest about it, in terms, mm-hmm. if you're a Christian, like, you believe it, like, it speaks to you profoundly. But can you honestly 100% say, like, I absolutely know? And Kierkegaard, I think, would say, no, you don't. But this compulsion that you have of belief, this faith, is so powerful that at the end of the day, it really is irrelevant. And so I think I would approach it in a Kierkegaardian way, because you don't get caught up in that, like, that kind of, in my opinion, is a waste of time trying to prove, disprove, or this is why God doesn't exist, this is why Christianity. It's not about that. So that's why I would.
When I was in my 20s, and I spent some time, like, going from church to church, trying to figure out what I was, like, mm-hmm. what kind of religion I believed in, if any. I had been an atheist in my teen years for a while. I'd been brought up in a Christian church, and then I went to a Unitarian church, which is organized agnosticism, as far as I'm concerned. And then, mm-hmm. and then I went from church to church, and around that same time, I started reading philosophy on my own. There's a story as to how I got interested in philosophy, you know, directly, rather than just pondering things in my head. And I found it worthwhile at that time to, like, look at some of the arguments for the existence of God, and, like, okay, now this one, it really proves it. What was the one that I thought was, there wasn't the argument from, it wasn't the ontological argument for the existence of God, but it was one where it was, like, the claim was, if you believe that the world outside of your senses, or the world that you perceive, is correlated to the world outside of your senses, then you must believe that you're a designed being yourself, that your eyes were designed to render the truth of the world, which means you believe there was someone who designed you, which means that you believe in God. So if you believe that the world that you perceive has some correlation at all to an external world, you must believe in God. That was the argument. I thought that was the greatest thing since sliced cheese. But people who are actually religious would and spiritual especially would tell me, like, this is about as dry as dust. I don't care about your argument about God. I have faith, and that's what I like to explore and to try to build, not a list of arguments from some old book. And I like a different old book. But I always had trouble with that, with that idea of leaping into faith and trying to develop faith, because it seemed to me that that first step was kind of arbitrary. But how would, you know, like, you didn't have a justification for the first commitment, like the I believe this. How does Kierkegaard address that hesitation to be part of the faithful? Or was it that he was already living in such a, that he was living in such a Christian community to begin with, that it wasn't a question as to whether you would be a Christian, but just how?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's the latter is pretty much, you know, and I think that's the case for a lot of Christians. You grow up into it. And so it's harder for you to, when you're approached with arguments like, well, you know, if you really think about this, this really doesn't make any sense logically. So, and for many Christians, of like what you're saying, it's like, well, you know, I'm not interested in whether it makes sense or not. What I'm it's just the benefit that it gives me. It's, you know, I think that it's more fulfilling for me. Yeah, I think Kierkegaard comes from it from that angle.
Yeah. And what is the story of, like, Abraham and Isaac tell you about faith, or what should we get out of the way Kierkegaard interprets that biblical story where God tells Abraham to take his son Isaac out and sacrifice him?
So he was trying to get into the mind of Abraham, where Abraham was very distraught that God asked him to kill his son Isaac. And so, of course, he's going through all this emotional turmoil, Abraham. At the same time, Abraham has faith. So in Abraham's mind, it's the case like, well, he's asked me to kill Isaac, but at the same time, that can't happen, right? Because he gave me Isaac, and Isaac is supposed to be the result, the end result that would lead toward Jesus, because, you know, the ancestry. So this is it.
Does he think of Jesus, or does he think of the Messiah, or
So in his mind, it's like it's this paradox is what's happening. It's this contradiction that's going on in his mind, that so what Kierkegaard is saying, I think, is he's saying that this is what faith is. And, you know, in general, like, it is a constant paradox, a contradiction. Like, that's what you experience when you experience faith. As you're experiencing this joy of believing in this being that you know is going to give you, provide for you fully. But at the same time, you have to go through this life experience of going through this, these things, that these horrible things that seemingly God asks of you. And I think what's important about what Kierkegaard is saying is not about, like, why is this happening. It's more just like this is happening. And you, in life, if you embrace faith, this is the situation. Like, you're going to experience these paradoxes and these contradictions, and you're going to have these intense moments of joy and sorrow, and that's what faith is. Right. And that's what I got out of it. But I think it's important to, when you're reading that, the Fear and Trembling, it's not about why would God do this? Like that's not what the story is about. And so what you're left with,
you're not trying to understand the mind of God when you read Fear and Trembling.
Yeah, exactly. Or like even, and you're not even, it's not even like a story of trying to convince you this is why you should believe in God or why you shouldn't believe. This is just, this is the Christian experience. So if you're not into this, then yeah, probably Christianity isn't for you. but if it is, if you really want to understand Christianity, I got some ideas for you that'll help you along your life path.
I'm going to give you an example of the kind of paradox that bothers me about the Christian story, but I'm not telling you this because I think it refutes anything, mm-hmm. but just because it's exactly the kind of contradiction that I feel like, if you have a certain Christian point of view, actually almost gives some support, at least to the kind of Christian experience that Kierkegaard is advocating. And I think he's advocating it, right? He's not just explaining it, but he's saying, hey, you Christians, you're not being really Christian. This is the way to experience Christianity. But let me tell you this little story. So when I was, again, I'm going back to my 20s because I really thought about religion a lot back then. And there was an old woman who lived down the hall from the apartment that my girlfriend, now wife, lived in at the time. And we would visit her and have tea and look at her pictures of herself petting a tiger. I remember that for some reason. She had gotten a chance to pet a tiger. She was very religious. And she was talking about how she was looking forward to being with God. And I asked her, so what do you think it will be like when you're in heaven? Will there be houses? Will you live like in a house? Will God live in a castle? Will you be with the people? Will you be with your first husband forever? How will there be the passage of time? And she thought about it and she decided, no, there wouldn't be houses and no, there wouldn't be a castle for God. And the more options I gave her to describe what heaven was like, the more she wanted to reject them all because none of them seemed like the kinds of things that she would want to be involved with forever. Like, you know, a house would be good for a while, but to live in the same neighborhood forever slid from heaven into hell in her mind. You know, it's like, so like one of the things about the notion of Christian eternity and heaven and being with God is that it is, anytime you try to put it into a picture or a story, it crumbles apart. You can't actually conceive of it. You can't, just like you can't conceive of death, the negation, you can't conceive of eternal life either. Mm-hmm. And so that's to me seems like that actually seems to me to be a bit Hegelian. You know, if you've read some Hegel, I think you've done something about Hegel on your channel. And I know Kierkegaard was influenced by Hegel, if only negatively, like he didn't like Hegel very much. But Hegel has this whole thing about how being becomes nothing. And the nothing becomes a substance that becomes being again or existence again. It's in the science of logic. And how if you try to imagine pure being, pure existence, what you'll actually conceive of is a nothing, right? And then, but if you consider that nothing for a time, you'll realize, oh, there must be some background for this nothing. For me to conceive it at all, it has an essence or being to it. So now the nothing is being again. I don't know. So what do you feel like Kierkegaard's relationship was to Hegel, especially when it comes to this idea of contradiction, which is so important to Hegel, as was Christianity?
You know, I, from what I gather, Kierkegaard was just, he thought Hegel really just was getting a little too abstract in the sense that he was getting too far off from human experience, and that's from what my understanding, and he was no longer focusing on like, okay, but how does this relate to the human experience? It's just like, well, you're just trying to explain things that are kind of pretty unexplainable. Kierkegaard didn't want to go in those kinds of directions where, like, okay, explain like ultimate being, or explain like, because, you know, there's argument, philosophical arguments where they talk about how God, what is God? God is being with a capital B. So what is that? And I think Kierkegaard was like, well, that's impossible for human beings to even like describe. Or when you're talking about how describe heaven, I think Kierkegaard would be like, well, there's no way we could, a human being could, it's beyond our comprehension. So I think Kierkegaard was more like, okay, let's just focus on, what we can describe and like the experience, our experience, and how, our limited interaction with the world and God, let's just focus on that. And I'll describe that. And I think that's where Kierkegaard and Hegel kind of went separate.
What does he mean when he talks about being a knight of faith?
Mm-hmm. From what I gather, the knight of faith is, kind of like the whole thing with Abraham, where you're able to, achieve or move forward in life through this embracement of faith, which is this embracement of this contradiction, to continue to move forward in that, as opposed to, coming up to that contradiction in life and then being defeated by despair, like not moving forward anymore. I think pretty much that's what it means, the knight of faith, or you're using your faith to continue to move forward and to achieve some form of happiness, despite the fact that life is filled with all these contradictions and paradoxes.
I recall Rick Roderick, and he has a lecture on Kierkegaard. But what he says is, like, despair, the problem with people today is not so much that they fall into despair, but they're incapable of feeling it.
Now, this is not a mood problem. A psychologist can't fix it, because this despair that Kierkegaard analyzes in this book constitutes the self. The self is this despairing relation. You can't be cured of it. You are it. You can't go to the psychologist and go, I'm in despair, fix it, in this sense. Because that would be to obliterate yourself that's built in this despairing relation. Now, despair, you go, that's too big a word. I'm not in despair that much. Still not thinking along the lines of Kierkegaard's argument. Because there are various forms of despair. And that's the despair that is unaware that it is despair. Now, you're going to all go, that's unfair, that's philosophical, that's unfair. No, Kierkegaard says that's the incurable kind. The incurable kind is the despair that is unaware that it is despair. Now, the reason that one's incurable is you haven't got the crisis. A crisis will make you face despair, and while it won't cure it, you'll know more about what you are as a self. The kind of despair that is unaware that it is despair, that's hopeless.
Despair is like the necessary, is necessary for human life. You have to be able to experience the despair of your existence before you can be a knight of faith or have a human existence at all. And if you spend your whole life like avoiding despair, avoiding that dark night of the soul, as Hegel might put it, then you miss out on developing a true faith.
That is part of life, right? Even for people who don't who say they avoid it, or was Rick Roderick was saying, like, people don't, the problem is people don't experience despair, but that's impossible. You're going to experience despair at some point just because you're living, right? Yeah, if you're alive, you will experience
even despair. If you watch TV all the time and go to the mall and take happy drugs, you're still gonna experience mm-hmm. despair, even if you load yourself up on Prozac and Netflix.
Yeah.
You're still going to experience it.
Mm-hmm. So I think,
okay,
what it is people, I mean, you have to accept it as just a fact or a critical aspect of life. And I think when people get defeated with despair, they feel like, oh, this is not a necessary, you know, this is not what life is, right? Or like, I'm doing something wrong, or I'm living in the wrong way. But no, this is what life is. So once you get to that point of realization, then you could, you can be that knight of faith.
Yeah, there's something kind of Freudian about this idea too, because Freud talked about how his goal in psychoanalysis was not to create happy, perfect people, but just to help people who are really sick experience ordinary misery. Do you think people are more prone to depression today than they were in the past, maybe because of social media? Because I remember one of your videos, you said that depression arises not so much just out of some sadness, or the way Kierkegaard talked about depression was not because you're just sad about something, but it's when you, or maybe it's despair that arises this way. It's when you have an image of yourself, an ego ideal, and then you recognize that your ego ideal is far superior to your actual self, when you see the gap between who, what you really are and what you want to be. Do you think that, like, because of Facebook and all Instagram and all these things, that we're confronted with our ego ideal even more than normal, and we're more likely to be filled with despair? I know I am. Take a look in the mirror as opposed to my selfie stick picture, and it's pretty depressing.
That's a question I'm not really sure about. I'm actually inclined to believe, like, no, we're not more depressed. I do think the whole social media thing has put it up in the spotlight, maybe. And I also think maybe today, because we're more aware of depression and anxiety as more clinical disorders or clinical problems, people are more aware, like, oh, this is actually a thing, as opposed to way far, you know, in the past, people just didn't acknowledge that, you know, people were in depression and anxiety were always a thing, but people were like, oh, that's not what's happening. You're either crazy or you just gotta, like, man up or something.
Yeah.
So, I don't know.
So you think that that despair is universal?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Let's see, what else do I have written down here for you? I already sort of asked you about Hegel's systematic philosophy and Kierkegaard rejecting it. Well, let me ask you this. Do you feel like Kierkegaard is a conservative figure in philosophy, trying to hold on to the Christian faith and a traditional kind of life? Or is he a radical trying to make changes? Or is that the wrong framework to approach him from within?
Yeah, I think it might be the wrong framework, but in a way it is. I think he is a radical trying to bring back the conservative, like the more original, like when Christianity was first, when it was first developed, before it was an institution, right. Which I guess is you get real, like, conservative.
For him, Christianity wasn't supposed to help you in your everyday worldly life, but rather break you from that.
I think so. And then in that way, Kierkegaard's kind of like fringe or like radical, because, you know, the way Christianity is taught even then, and, you know, the institutionalized Christianity is, it's more like self-help type of thing, which, I mean, you could use it in that way, but I would say it's more, you know, it's also a bigger way of using Christianity would be what you just described.
Well, listen, we've been talking for about 40 minutes. What I thought I'd do is ask you one more question about philosophy, and then we could take a break and do another round, just sort of chatting for my patrons. You know, I got this Patreon. Would you be willing to do that?
Sure.
Okay. So my final question is, like, what are you doing next on your channel? What should people who are interested in the Black Ponderer and in philosophy expect from you next? What book are you doing next?
Yeah, so I'm going to continuing. I'm talking about Hegel, and I'm reading through Hegel's lectures. So my next video is going to be on Hegel's History of Philosophy, Volume 2. That's going to be my next video.
How are you finding Hegel?
Oh, he's cool. I like, he's very traditional, old school philosophy, very dense, and a lot of ideas packed into a small amount, and is also a lot of it. So he's like one of those really traditional, rigorous philosophers. But I do like reading him; it's enjoyable.
Which of the videos that you've made are the most popular on your channel?
That'll definitely be the Nietzsche stuff. Yeah, those get a lot of hits. Yeah, the Nietzsche. Another popular one is Brothers Karamazov, but Dostoevsky, and some of them feminist videos get a lot of hits.
Yeah, and do you find that you identify, like, do you cover people whose work you don't like who you find yourself opposed to, but you'll cover it anyway? At times, I want to say to everybody out there, I'm not, that didn't come to mind just because you mentioned feminism. All right, but go ahead.
I do read books that I disagree with, but it's not that I don't like them. Is I don't ever read a book where the argument is too weak to. A lot of times, that's what I find. The books that I don't like are books where they're giving you an argument, but the argument is so weak, or it's just no philosophical rigor involved, where it's like, I don't even want to talk about it. It's just a waste of time. But I have covered books that I disagree with, but the argument behind them is very strong. So I really have to go in deep as to why I disagree with.
Like what? So like, can you give me an example of, can you think of one that you disagreed with and you had to, but the argument was almost knocked down?
Mm-hmm. Like Nietzsche's Beyond Good and Evil. Like I disagree with that book, but he poses a very strong argument.
Just real quick, tell me what it is, and then even faster if you can, and I know I'm asking a lot, how do you try to refute it in your video?
The general idea is, the title is pretty good, is like, we need to break away from morality and ethics. They're limitations, right? There are, we just get bogged down in these moral constructs that really prevent us from actually living. And so Nietzsche argues, like, well, you know, I'm not against morality per se. Like, what we should do is we should create our own morality for us personally. Each person should have their own, and then use that to, create a better life for yourself. And don't just do that out just casually, like, really focus, you know, use philosophical rigor and intellect and develop a really strong moral base for yourself. Right. And I disagree with that, because I mean, you kind of, like, that's kind of the problem with the world now, right? You're seeing, like, a lot of, we have these moral paradigms that are out today that are really hurting a lot of people. Like, an example would go back to the climate change, where, you know, a lot, there's the argument to be made, like, well, there's oil in the ground, we should just dig it out, right? I mean, why leave it there? It's like, you're wasting so much potential, and so much jobs could be made. And that's a moral argument. And there's people out there who are like, I think if you just leave the oil in the earth, look at all the jobs you'll waste, or like on all the livelihood of people that you'll not
provide for.
But then of course the other argument is like, well, in fossil fuel is heating the environment, and more people will die if we continue to use fossil fuel. But then the other side would be like, well, what about my livelihood and this and that? And so what happens is you get to these these bouts of like, well, my individual morality is better than your individual morality. And then it just gets all violent and stuff like that. Rather, what we should do is we should come together, right? And morality is not something that we should develop on our own, especially not on our own, because we don't know, we can't determine by ourselves what is moral, you know, and what's good and what's bad. Like, and then even like small groups, like, no, we need to come as a whole, as humanity, and have like a huge discussion. Okay, what's good, what's bad, what's going to hurt people, what's not going to hurt people. And so we should not go beyond good and evil. Like, we should be talking about, like, that's something that we should not be going beyond. Right.
Right. Thanks for watching this Zero Books video. If you enjoyed it, subscribe to this channel and click on the notifications bell so that you'll be alerted whenever we release a new video. You should also consider supporting us on Patreon. Our patrons get access to our Inside Zero Books podcast every week and can get access to the Zero Books Book Club and help us to continue making online content from the left.